Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Empty Promise podcast. I think.
For now.
Welcome to episode 142 of the podcast. You are joining me and my best friend, James D. Downey.
Hello.
On what is a long and eagerly anticipated return to the mics. I'm looking forward to this, D. This is a big topic that I'm very much looking forward to bringing you today. But before we get into that, how have you been?
You know, it's only been a couple of weeks since the last podcast, so there's not really much to update on. No, but in reality,
it's only been about 32 weeks.
32 weeks? That's really nothing. Really nothing. Very little. You know, which I suppose no news is good news sometimes.
Yep.
Nice, quiet. I mean, the last episode we did a big update on all the shit that happened in our lives.
Yeah.
And, you know, subsequently from that moment, very little has happened. Yeah. That's life kind of works, I suppose.
Well, I'm the same. And I don't want to bore people with the boring parts of my life, so...
I've skipped over, like, all this amazing stuff that's happening because in the interest of time.
Exactly.
Obviously, I do lead a very exciting, interesting life. And, you know, week to week, many things... my life is basically a sitcom.
Yeah.
Well, look at... To not drag things down.
Yeah.
Just skip over it. Nah, been quiet.
We can touch on those in another episode. How's about that? We'll just do an episode purely devoted to the interesting things that have happened in our lives.
Uh-huh. Yes.
But for today...
That'll be a short episode.
But for today, and in the interest of time, as you said, because it's a big one today. It's a doozy.
Mm.
I've looked forward to bringing you this story. You have no idea what it is.
No.
You have no clue whatsoever. I just told you during the week to come along.
I mean, I can see your notes in the mirror, but yeah, I have no idea.
I forgot there was a mirror behind me.
Yeah, there is a mirror, but I actually can't see it.
Okay. You'd have a hard job reading the notes anyway.
Yeah, that's fair. I've got astigmatisms. Okay. I can't see so good, okay?
Okay. I'm going to take a little sip off this delicious beverage before we start.
Christopher is drinking a Monster Energy Ultra Rosa.
Mm, my first one in about 4 weeks, so I need that little
He's box. Already got the fucking jitters.
Mm-hmm.
Before we begin, I shall also crack open...
Beautiful.
The Rosa.
Beautiful.
Thank you, by the way.
Cheers, by the way.
Cheers.
Yeah. Here's welcome to a back. Good show. Yeah.
Fuck, we drank at the same time. Dead air, dead air. It's not good. No, we're out of practice.
D, are you ready?
Whip. Okay, now I'm ready.
So feel free along as we move along through this story to... we'll kind of pause and get your thoughts and what you're thinking so far, because it's a bit of a mystery, this one.
Excellent.
Well, and
do you think I'll be able to solve it?
Potentially.
Do you think with the information you give me, I can crack the case?
Well, this case wasn't necessarily
crackable.
Quote unquote cracked until
today.
2022. And it happened back in 1945, I believe. 48, sorry.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Okay, this is good.
Okay, so 2022, and even at that, but we'll touch on this later, even at that, I'm not entirely convinced of the 2022.
So not all the questions have been answered. Okay. All right.
At 7 o'clock on the warm evening of Tuesday, November 30th, 1948, jeweller John Bain Lyons and his wife went for a stroll on Somerton Beach, a seaside resort a few miles south of Adelaide. As they walked towards Glenelg, they noticed a smartly dressed man lying on the sand across from the crippled children's home. His head propped against the seawall, he was lolling about 20 yards from them.
Lolling?
Yeah, lolling.
He was lolling along?
Did you snigger there at crippled children?
I didn't snigger. How dare you imply that I would? That's different time.
Different time.
That is that article. I'm assuming that at the time that's what it was called, and that's not just what...
That's what it was known as at the time, the crippled children's home.
Dear, oh dear.
Yeah. His head propped against the seawall. He was lolling 20 yards... from them, legs outstretched, feet crossed. As the couple watched, the man extended his right arm upward, then let it fall back to the ground. Lyons thought he might be making a drunken attempt to smoke a cigarette. Half an hour later, another couple noticed the same man lying in the same position. Looking on him from above, the woman could see that he was immaculately dressed in a suit, with smart shoes polished to a mirror shine. Odd clothing for the beach.
Mm.
He was motionless, his left arm splayed out in the sand. The couple decided that he was simply asleep, his face surrounded by mosquitoes. Quote, he must be dead to the world not to notice them, the boyfriend joked.
Oh dear.
It was not until the next morning that it became obvious that the man was not so much dead to the world as actually
just dead.
This is the case of the Somerton man, D.
The Somerton Man.
The Somerton Man.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. We're going down under for this one. So John Lyons returned from a morning swim to find some people clustered at the seawall where he had previously walked the night before. Walking over, he saw a figure slumped in much the same position he had, resting on the seawall, feet crossed. Now, though, the body was cold. There were no marks of any sort of violence. A half-smoked cigarette was lying in the man's collar as though it had fallen from his mouth. One of the witnesses told the police that she observed a man looking down at the sleeping man from the top of the steps that led to the beach.
Mm.
So the man himself, according to pathologist John Burton Cleland, the man was of Britisher appearance. That's a strange
word. That is a weird word, but this is the 40s. So
it's the 40s.
They say weird things.
He's Britisher.
Yeah. In an American accent in Australia. Yeah, what can I say? He's a Britisher, right?
The man was of Britisher appearance and thought to be aged around 40 to 45. He was in, quote, top physical condition. He was 180 centimetres tall with grey eyes, fair to ginger coloured hair, slightly grey around the temples, with broad shoulders and a narrow waist, hands and nails that showed signs of no manual labour, big and little toes that met in a wedge shape, like those of a dancer or someone who wore boots with pointed toes, and pronounced high calf muscles, consistent with people who regularly wore boots or shoes, or with the heels performed in ballet.
Interesting.
It was put forward that this guy was in like serious physical shape.
Yeah.
Like he was a specimen for the time.
Right.
Yeah, really, really good shape. Now, not saying like he was huge running, but he was lean, muscular. He had these really defined calves and his feet. You know those little like plinths that ballerinas wear that force all the toes together?
Oh, yeah, yeah,
like,
yeah.
That's the way like, his feet were kind of pointed.
The other thing, you said he didn't have like, his hands weren't workman's hands. So like, he's not built up this like strength performance over like physical labor.
No.
Doesn't sound like anyway.
No. The man
sounds quite well to do as well, just the way he was dressed.
Exactly.
As well.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Yeah, strange attire for a beach.
Yeah.
And to be lying across from a crippled children's home. I don't know if the crippled children's home has anything to do.
Is it any bearing here?
It will serve no reference for a later point in this story.
It was there.
It just happened to be there.
Yeah.
He was dressed in a white shirt, a red and white and blue tie, brown trousers, socks and shoes, a brown knitted pullover, and fashionable grey and brown double-breasted jacket of reportedly, quote, American tailoring.
Hmm.
All labels on his clothes had been removed, which for the time wasn't, I was reading, people were saying this wasn't uncommon because back then a lot of people did like thrift shopping. A lot of people bought clothes in like thrift stores, and you know, when clothes made it into thrift stores with like someone's name on it, they would like rip them off.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
it wasn't completely unusual. And that he had no wallet on him, which was unusual for 1948. Everybody carried a wallet. Everybody carried some form of like identification wallet, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
He was clean shaven and carried no identification, which led police to believe that he had committed suicide. Finally, his dental records were not able to be matched with any known person. So an autopsy then had to be conducted, and the pathologist estimated that the time of death was around 2 a.m. on the 1st of December. Quote, the heart was of normal size and normal in every way. Small vessels not commonly observed in the brain were easily discernible with congestion. There was congestion of the pharynx, and the gullet was covered with whitening of superficial layers, with patches of ulceration in the middle of it. The stomach was deeply congested. There was congestion in the second half of the duodenum. There was blood mixed with the food in the stomach. Both kidneys were congested, and the liver contained great excess of blood in its vessels.
Holy shit.
The spleen was strikingly large, about three times the normal size, and there was a destruction of the center of the liver lobules revealed under the microscope. Acute gastritis hemorrhage, extensive congestion of the liver and spleen, and the congestion to the brain. So this dude must have been in considerable pain.
This guy was literally all fucked up inside.
Inside, yeah.
Everywhere.
Bleeding everywhere, ulcerations everywhere. Mm-hmm.
That's obscene.
They were really, really like...
unpleasant. Kind
of, yeah, horrific. Yeah. Really. The autopsy also showed that the man's last meal was a pasty, eaten about 3 to 4 hours before his death. But tests reveal any foreign substance in the body.
Okay.
So they kind of wanted to rule out like poisoning or...
Really?
Mm.
Oh, so that was my immediate like assumption, yeah, is that he's been poisoned.
Well, when you hear that your spleen is three times its normal size. Yeah. Something's not quite
your
right.
Your liver has blood in it. Mm. All of your major organs are congested.
Like, no, all tests reveal to show any foreign substance. So
weird.
A search of his pockets revealed an unused second-class rail ticket from Adelaide to Henley Beach, a bus ticket from the city that may not have been used, a narrow aluminium comb that had been manufactured in the USA, a half-empty packet of Juicy Fruit chewing gum, an Army Club cigarette packet which contained seven cigarettes of a different kind, and a quarter full box of Bryant and May matches.
I'm calling it right now.
Yeah.
The Juicy Fruit. Yeah, it was so? The Juicy Fruit, 100%. Man, what are they putting in there? We don't know what they're putting in there.
It's addictive, Juicy Fruit. It's addictive. Fruit. Juicy Fruit's probably one of the best gum. for the opening 10 seconds.
Yeah, for the opening 10 seconds. Away. Yeah, you're fair. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's his problem. He was craving that hit over and over again.
So we heard there an aluminium comb manufactured in the USA, an Army Club cigarette pocket, cigarettes that didn't match the box in which they were housed in.
Okay.
All very strange stuff. Remember, this guy's lying on a beach in Australia.
Yeah, the comb could have just been...
just aluminium.
Imported.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I'm trying to get a read on this guy. Okay. Is he American or not?
Well, the investigating pathologist re-examined the body and made a number of clear discoveries. He noted that the man's shoes were remarkably clean and appeared to have been recently polished, rather than in the condition of a man who had apparently been wandering around the Glenelg all day.
Yes, because if you're walking on the beach, that's going to get scuffed up.
Scuffed, sandy, all that kind of stuff. He added that... this evidence fitted with the theory that the man may have been brought to Somerton Park Beach after the man's death, accounting for the lack of evidence of vomiting and convulsions, which are the two main physiological reactions to poison.
Yes.
So if this man had been poisoned, he might have had like maybe some vomit or spew maybe in his clothes. Nothing.
All over the place.
So they're saying that maybe he was brought here
after death.
Mm-hmm.
But we saw his arm move.
Yeah.
This goes deeper.
Strange. So Cleland speculated that this was a pathologist that as none of the witnesses could positively identify the man they saw the previous night as the same person discovered the next morning, there remained the possibility that the man had died elsewhere and had been dumped. Now this is a bit strange. Like, what are the chances on that guy that they've seen not being the same guy who was lying there? He stressed that this was purely speculation, and the witnesses did believe that it was, quote, definitely the same person, as the body was lying in the same place and in the same distinctive position.
Yeah. So one hand, if he was poisoned and left there, likely he should have been throwing up, convulsing, he should have been all over the place. But if he was poisoned earlier and then moved there, how was he seemingly moving around?
Yes, exactly.
To the witnesses.
Exactly. And everything was clean about him, you know.
And they witnessed him like late evening, but the estimate of time of death was like early morning.
Early morning of the
day
before.
So, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe it was a different person.
So we jump forward to 14th of January, 1949. So about 2 weeks after this. Uh-huh. And staff at the Adelaide railway station discovered a brown suitcase with its label removed, which had been checked into the station cloakroom after 11 a.m. on the 30th of November, 1948. It is believed that the suitcase was owned by the man found on the beach. In the case were a red checked dressing gown, a size 7 red felt pair of slippers, four pairs of underpants, pajamas, shaving items, a light brown pair of trousers with sand in the cuffs, an electrician's screwdriver, a table knife cut down into a sharp instrument, a pair of scissors with sharpened points, a small square of zinc, thought to have been used as a protective sheath for the knife, and scissors, a stenciling brush as used by third officers on merchant ships for stenciling cargo.
Okay.
Also in the case was a thread card of Barber brand orange waxed thread. So this wax thread, which is an unusual type because it's not actually available in Australia anywhere.
Ah.
This thread was the same thread used to repair the lining in a pocket of the trousers of the dead man which he was wearing.
Cool. So that's how they
kind of linked it. All identification marks on the clothes had been removed, but police found the same, quote, T Keen, so T.K.E.A.N.E, on a tie, Keen on a laundry bag, and Keen on a singlet, all inside the bag. However, they were all spelled differently, One was K-E-A-N-E, one was K-E-E-N-E, and one was K-E-A-N, along with three dry cleaning marks. Police believe that whoever removed the clothing tags either overlooked these three items or purposely left the Keen tags on all the clothes, knowing Keen was not the dead man's name.
Mm.
With wartime rationing still enforced, clothing was difficult to acquire at the time, although it was a very common practice to use name tags. It was also common when buying secondhand clothing to remove the tags of any previous owners. What was unusual was that there were no spare socks found in the case and no correspondence, although the police found pencils and unused letter stationery.
It's weird. This like case seems... It's an eclectic mix of stuff,
mm-hmm.
like knives and scissors and other pieces of utility, yeah. and then a couple of clothes, no socks.
Kind of almost sounds like a military, like soldiery kind of, maybe?
Yeah, kind of. Well, I was kind of leaning more workman-y. Yeah.
But remember, this guy had no signs of like...
Yeah, physical labor.
Physical labor. Maybe he wore gloves all the time.
He really likes his hands. But yeah, that is weird. It just doesn't sound like a suitcase. It's something I typically attribute with what you're you're traveling with, like yeah. your personal items. Or these don't sound like personal items. They sound like tools and stuff like that. A couple of pairs, no socks, a couple of pairs of trousers, whatever. So yeah, my theory
so far,
my guess is yeah. that this was not packed by him, and it was packed with stuff that they wanted to link to him, or to link away or keep away okay. from themselves. Yeah. I suspect foul play, Chris.
Okay.
there's more here.
Are you willing to give that statement to the
I would like to speak with the pathologist, please.
Okay. I suspect foul play, sir. A search concluded that no T. Keen was missing in any English-speaking country. A nationwide...
What? Hold on.
Mm-hmm.
So in 1949, they determined that there was no T. Keen missing in any English-speaking country. Yeah. All of the United States, all of the UK.
Anywhere in Europe. Everywhere. They just,
anywhere they spoke English.
They roll this out. Yes.
All of the colonies.
I don't know if we talked about it here, but they actually, I don't know if I've put the notes in, but they pushed this case over to Scotland Yard as well. They pushed it all the way. Yeah.
Okay, so it was big news.
Big news.
Okay.
They needed some serious help with this case. Not saying that Australia detectives were incompetent, but this was this was something that was like...
Well, if they thought he was a Britisher...
A Britisher, yeah.
They probably wanted to enlist the help of the British.
Yeah. A nationwide circulation of the dry cleaning marks also proved fruitless. All that could be generated or garnered from the suitcase was that the front gusset and feather stitching on a coat found in the case identified had been manufactured in the United States.
More.
The coat had not been imported, indicating that the man had been to America or bought it from someone of similar size who had been.
Yeah.
So the coat hadn't been brought in. He had the coat packed himself. Police checked incoming train tickets and believed that the man had arrived in the Adelaide railway station overnight from either Melbourne, Sydney, or Port Augusta. They speculated that he had showered and shaved at the adjacent city baths, although there were no baths ticket on his body. So city baths at the time were a place where people could shave and clean up, but you needed a stamp, you needed a ticket to get into these places.
Okay.
It's kind of a strange thing though, isn't it?
I don't know. It's like kind of like, you know, like airports these days have like showers
yeah,
and stuff.
Yeah, true, actually. He had been to the city bath, then went to the railway station to purchase a ticket for the 10:50 a.m. train to Henley Beach, which... For whatever reason, he did not board. He immediately checked his suitcase at the station cloakroom before leaving the station and catching the city bus to Glenelg, and that's where he was found on that beach. Although named City Baths, the centre was not a public bathing facility, but rather a public swimming pool. The railway station bathing facilities were adjacent to the station cloakroom, which itself was adjacent to the station's south exit onto the North Terrace. And there's no record of the station's bathroom facilities being unavailable at the day he arrived.
Right, yeah.
So why he went to there instead of just using the baths at the station
okay.
is unknown. At around the same time as the inquest, a tiny piece of rolled up paper with the words Tamam Shud printed on it was found in a fob pocket, so a fake pocket, sewn into the dead man's trouser pocket.
The trousers he was wearing mm-hmm. when he was dead.
He had a fake pocket, a fob pocket. So a pocket that like you would put something in, you know, if you were trying to smuggle.
Yeah.
T-A-M-A-M-S-H-U-D.
Tamam.
Tamam Shud. And we'll get to this, don't worry.
What's the word? I was going to say Aramaic, but it's not Aramaic.
Yeah, you're very close.
Hebrew.
It's Persian. It's from Persian descent, okay? So public library officials were called in to translate, and it translates to a phrase meaning ended or finished, or it is finished.
No way.
Found on the last page of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam, which is a book, but we'll get to that too.
Interesting.
Yes.
It is finished.
It is finished. So the Rubaiyat of Omar is a title, is a book that Edward Fitzgerald gave to his 1859 translation from Persian of England. It's a sequence of quatrains, you know,
like, oh, right, yeah. it's like poetry.
Yeah, poetry, prose. Basically. And he was dubbed the astronomer poet of Persia. And I think this Rubaiyat is kind of like, it's a book back then that you would maybe use to like help court someone. So like if you fancied someone, you'd be like, I have the Rubaiyat, you know.
Oh,
you
might, right,
give,
okay,
the Rubaiyat to someone you like or you fancy, you love, you know, as this way. It's like, it's love,
a
poetry, that
it's
kind
an
of
erotic
thing.
Book.
Yeah, well, it could be. It's 1800s erotica,
yeah,
from,
yeah,
Persia.
Yeah. So there's people showing their ankle and all sorts.
That's what I get from the Rubaiyat. So this paper's verso side, so the other side, was blank. Police conducted an Australia-wide search to find the copy of the book. This book was extremely rare.
Oh, really? Right.
Like at the time, in this particular print, I think there was only like between 1 and 300 copies in the world, from which this page was ripped out.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's something you can track down.
Exactly.
Presumably.
Police conducted an Australia-wide search to find a copy of the book that had a similarly blank verso. A photograph of the scrap piece of paper was then released to the press. Following a public appeal to the police, the copy of the Rubaiyat from which the page had been torn was located. However, there is some great uncertainty about the circumstances under which this particular book was found. One newspaper article refers to the book being found about a week or two before the body was found.
Hmm.
And former South Australian police detective Gary Feltis, who dealt with this matter as a cold case, reports that if the book was found just after the man was found at the beach, this timing is super significant, as the man is presumed, based on the suitcase, to have arrived in Adelaide the day before. If the book was found 1 or 2 weeks before, it suggests that the man had previously visited and had been in Adelaide a long time before he died.
Oh, yeah, sense. Yeah. Right,
so
enough.
When the book was found plays a huge, huge role in this. But in July, a full 8 months after the investigation had begun, the search for the proper Rubaiyat, this exact book from which this page was ripped, produced results. And on the 23rd of July, a Glen Elg man walked into the detective office in Adelaide with a copy of the book and a very strange story.
Hmm.
Early the previous December, just after the discovery of the unknown body, he had gone for a drive with his brother-in-law in a car he kept parked a few hundred yards away from Somerton Beach. The brother-in-law had found a copy of the Rubaiyat lying on the floor by the back seats. Each man had silently assumed it belonged to the other, and the book had just sat in the glove compartment ever since.
No way.
Yeah. Alerted by a newspaper article about the search, the two men had gone back to take a closer look, and they found that the part of the final page had been torn out together with the Khayyam's final words. The book was missing the words Tamam Shud on the last page, which had a blank reverse, and microscopic tests indicate that the piece of paper was from the page torn from the book.
That's wild.
Mm-hmm. So these two guys who, like, what, six, yeah, 7 months later, they were like, hang on a second, I was in my brother-in-law's car, I seen a copy of that book. When they were there together, one, they just assumed, like, it's like me, yeah, jumping into your car and being like, 100%. I assume that's your book, and you thinking, I assume that's Chris's book.
You know what's really cool about that, though, is just that it sounds like something you don't ever see in a film.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, oh, we have a missing page. We have a page ripped out of a book. If we can just find the book that
very
it came from.
A very distinct book, too. A very, like, it's, yeah, it's not like it's just a copy of, like, what's a super popular book now? It's not like...
Like Harry Potter or,
yeah,
something like
it's
that.
Not like a Harry Potter. It's a distinct print. Only a couple of hundred of these been.
Yeah.
It's the exact words at the final page ripped,
yeah,
out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so significant, too.
It's
very finished as well, yeah, what it says.
Finished. Poetic.
Poetic, yeah. Poetic. Whoever left it, or for whatever reason it was there, mm-hmm, seems to have significant,
exactly,
meaning.
And we'll talk about theories and stuff later on based on this book, but...
Excellent.
But Dee, I'm going to blow your mind a wee bit more first, because in the back of this book were faint indications representing 5 lines of text in capital letters. And the lines read, WRGOABABD. Second line, MLIAOI. And that line has been completely stroked out. Third line, WTBIMPANETP. Fourth line, MLIABO. And there's a star that has been crossed out above the O. IAQC. Fourth line, ITTMTSAMSTGAB.
So it's like you've lost me.
That it's code. Really, it's code. It's cipher. It's something.
Mm, interesting. Interesting. Anyone who just tuned in there, by the way, at that exact moment, yeah, is just thinking that Chris is like, he's reading out his Windows product key.
Just rebooting. Yeah. So the letters were thought to be in words in a foreign language. However, it was then released that this was a code. It was some kind of cipher. Code experts were then called in.
Oh, I love it when code experts get called in, man.
And called in to try to decipher the line, but were completely unsuccessful.
This is very like something that I hopefully will cover in depth one day.
Yes.
The Zodiac.
Yeah.
And all the cryptic
codes.
That's
what this reminded me of when I heard this. I was like,
hilarious as well to me that... they wrote it on the back of the book, or exactly, whatever letter they wrote. They wrote it on the book that they were going to use in this like murder.
Amateurs attempted to crack the code. Everybody was completely unsuccessful. In 1978, following a request from ABC's television journalist Stuart Littlemore, cryptographers analyzed the handwritten text. The cryptographers reported that it would be impossible to provide, quote, a satisfactory answer if the text were an encrypted image. Its brevity meant that it had insufficient symbols from which clear meaning could be extracted, and the text could be a, quote, meaningless product of a disturbed mind.
Mm.
So they're saying this could just be a whole pile of gibberish. Yeah. Who knows? In the back of the book, though, investigators also found, this book is everything, a telephone number.
Oh, wow.
And Detective Sergeant Lionel Lean took a close look at the book. Almost at once, he found a telephone number penciled on the rear cover, and using a magnifying glass, he dimly made out the faint impression of some other letters written in capital letters.
Holy
underneath
shit.
Here, at least, was a solid clue to go on. So, the telephone number that was found in the back of the book belonged to a nurse named Jessica Ellen, or Jo Thompson. She was born Jessie Harkness in the Sydney suburb of Macaville, New South Wales, who lived in Mosley Street, Glenelg, about 400 metres north of the location where the body was found. When she was interviewed by the police, however, Thompson said that she did not know the dead man or why he would have her phone number and choose to visit her suburb on the night of his death. However, she also reported that at some time in late 1948, an unidentified man had attempted to visit her and asked a next-door neighbour about her. In his book on the case, Jerry Feltus stated that when he interviewed Thompson in 2002, he found that she was either being evasive or she did not wish to talk about it. Feltus believed Thompson knew the Somerton man's identity, knew of his body, and when she was shown the plaster cast of bust of the dead man that was made, Thompson said that she could not identify the person depicted. According to Lean, though, he described her reaction upon seeing the cast as completely taken aback to the point of giving the appearance that she was about to faint.
Oh my God.
In an interview many years later, Paul Lawson, the technician who made the cast and who was present when Thompson viewed it, noted that after looking at the bust, she immediately looked away and would not look at it again.
So she is very suspicious.
Very suspicious,
what I'm gathering.
Yes. Like, she almost knows this man, has something to do with this man, couldn't look at the cast.
Yeah, and then he's lying about it.
Lives 400 metres from where the man was found dead.
Had his number, he was asking about her.
Yep.
It's interesting to me as well that was 2002, you said, that she did this. So this is many, many, many years
many
later.
Years, yeah.
And she's still, like, you know, because at that point, there's, like, if something you wanted to hide, something you were embarrassed about or something, you know, you wanted to keep from police at the time. It's like, it's so many years later. You think, why not just be honest about it now? But she still was like,
don't know, despite it.
Being visibly...
Exactly. So Thompson also said that while she was working at Royal North Shore Hospital in Sydney during World War II, she had owned a copy of the Rubaiyat.
Oh!
Yeah. In 1945, at the Clifton Garden Hotel in Sydney, she had given it to an Australian Army lieutenant named Alf Boxall, who was serving at the time in the water transport section of the Royal Australian Engineers. Thompson told police that after the war ended, she had moved to Melbourne and married. She said that she had received a letter from Boxall and that she had replied, telling him that she was now married. There was no evidence that Boxall had any contact with Thompson after 1945. Jessica Thompson requested that police not keep a permanent record of her name or release details to third parties, as it would be embarrassing and harmful to the reputation and be linked to be linked to such a case.
Mm.
The police at the time agreed, a decision that later hampered investigations.
Yeah.
In news media, books, and other discussions of the case, Thompson was frequently referred to by various pseudonyms, including the name Jestyn, spelled J-E-S-T-Y-N.
What?
Yeah.
That is such a strange spelling. Well, and a strange name, I guess.
As a result of their conversations with Thompson, police suspected that Boxall was the dead man. So that this guy that she was talking to, Alf Boxall, was the dead man. However, in July 1949, Boxall was found in Sydney, and the final page of his copy of the Rubaiyat was still intact, with the words Tamam Shud still in place. So Boxall had been working in the maintenance section at Randwick Bus Depot, where he had worked before the war, and was unaware of any link between the dead man and himself whatsoever. So, completely oblivious to what was going on, basically.
So he's alive and well. He has his book on, whatever, yeah, unmarred.
However, in the front copy of the Rubaiyat that was given to Boxall, so the one that Jess gave to this man, Alf Boxall, Jessica Harkness had signed herself as Jestyn. Capital J, capital E, S-T-Y-N.
Oh!
And rewritten out verse 70 of the Tamam Shud, which read, "Indeed, indeed, repentance oft before. I swore, but was I sober when I swore? And then came spring, and rose in hand, my threadbare penitence a pieces tore."
Okay.
Yeah. So this, first of all, Jestyn, capital J, capital E, S-T-Y-N. The most ridiculous way to sign a name. And everything that I've read, and everybody says that this is perhaps just another cipher. That this lady is in on this kind of shit.
What I was thinking is, like, is this just like... Okay, so this book has connotations to suggest that it's like shared between lovers.
Yes.
Right? It's like a romantic, it's like a courting thing, whatever. And she gave this to this guy, which I'm not sure how unseemly it is for, like, you know, like in the 40s, it would have been like, oh, she's unmarried and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But she left this with him and she signed it Jestyn. But I wonder, is that like a pet name or like a name that they shared so that, you know, they could talk about each other without being like scandalous?
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not talking about this nurse who's unmarried and blah, blah, blah. I'm talking about Jestyn. Who's this?
But I find it strange that was back in 1949. She gave him that copy of the book and she signed her name in the front of that then, J-E-S-T-Y-N. But during when she was interviewed in 2002, she then went under the pseudonym of Jestyn.
Yeah, but that's... So, yeah, like, did she suggest that?
Yeah,
is that where it came from? Or did they just pull that back because they were like, well, we have a book from this time?
Yeah, potentially.
Yeah, you know?
I just thought that was strange. I was like, that's a bit... So is Jessica up to something here? Maybe. A lot of people kind of pointing the finger. We'll get to different theories and stuff, but Jessica right now is like her number one.
Very suspicious.
Yeah.
Yeah, very suspicious. But the thing is, as well, is that there's nothing actually, like, seemingly linking her to the guy who's dead. Everyone's, I mean, the book, I guess. But, like, everything else is suggesting she was just lying for some reason.
Yeah, but we don't know why.
Yeah.
In 1949, so jumping back to 1949, the body of the unknown man was buried in Adelaide's West Terrace Cemetery, where the Salvation Army conducted the service. The South Australian Grandstand Bookmakers Association paid for the service to save the man from a pauper's burial. On the tombstone, it read, "Here lies the unknown man who was found at Somerton Beach, December 1st, 1948. Years later after the burial, flowers began appearing on the grave, and police questioned a woman seen leaving the cemetery, but she claimed she knew nothing of the man. There had been persistent speculation that the dead man was a spy, due to the circumstances and historical context of his death. At least two sites relatively close to Adelaide were of interest to spies. They were the Radium Hill Uranium Mine, and the Woodmera Test Range, which was an Anglo-Australian military research facility. The man's death also coincided with a reorganisation of Australian security agencies, which would culminate the following year with the founding of the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, and this would be followed by a crackdown on Soviet espionage in Australia, which was revealed by intercepts of Soviet communications under the Venona Project, which we could do a whole episode on the Venona project if we wanted. This was this big crackdown to intercept spy messages in Australia from the Soviet Union, which involved like the NKVD, the KGB, and the GRU. That was initiated when the Soviet Union was an ally of the US, and the program continued during the Cold War when the Soviet Union was considered an enemy. During the 37-year duration of the Venona project, the Signal Intelligence Service decrypted and translated approximately 3,000 messages. So it was a huge, huge crackdown at the time. And people are saying this guy could have just been a spy. There was the uranium mine, and then there was this other like base. Yeah,
the research facility. I mean, and then the fact that there's like a kind of cryptic kind of code.
Around that time as well. Like that's what, 1940? That's after World War II?
Yeah. Yeah. But that's really interesting. The whole spy theory did not click with me at all.
Yeah.
I was completely sold on the lover's quarrel.
Yeah.
Well, but it makes a lot of sense when you think about it that way.
Well, there was a massive crackdown in catching Soviet spies in Australia at the time. And this leads us back to Jessica Thompson. But in particular, Jessica Thompson had a daughter called Kate.
Okay.
Okay, so years have passed. She has a daughter called Kate. Kate was interviewed by police. And she said that her mother was the woman interviewed by the police, and that her mother had blatantly lied to them. She said that her mother had lied to them, and Jessica did know the identity of the Somerton man, and his identity was also, quote, known to a level higher than the police force.
Interesting.
So there's somebody else. Yeah, exactly.
So the Australian like security intelligence. Exactly.
She suggested that her mother and the Somerton man may have both been spies, noting that Jessica Thompson taught English to migrants, was interested in communism, and could speak Russian. Although she would not disclose to Kate where she had learned it or why.
That's pretty... I mean, speaking Russian in Australia does seem...
a bit...
unusual. Why? You know, yeah. A bit unusual. I'm really leaning into this now.
This is a big one now.
I'm being convinced here.
Another theory concerns our friend Alf Boxall. Okay, remember the guy
he was a soldier, mm-hmm. He got the book. Yeah.
Who was reportedly involved in intelligence work during and immediately after World War II. Boxall's army service records suggest that he served initially in the 4th Water Transport Company before being seconded to the North Australian Observer Unit, a special operations unit, and that during his time with the NAOU, Boxall rose, I say rapidly, but people are saying it's too rapidly. Like super quickly in rank, being promoted from Lance Corporal, which is the bottom of the bottom, to Lieutenant within 3 months.
Whoa.
Which was just completely unheard of.
Okay.
Why he made that kind of progress, don't know.
He's that good.
Yeah, well, he was, yeah, maybe.
He's just that good, Chris.
In 1994, John Harper Phillips, who was the Chief Justice of Victoria and the Chairman of the Victorian Institute of Forensic Medicine, reviewed the case to determine the cause of death and concluded that there seems little doubt it was digitalis, which is a poison, I assume. Phillips supported his conclusion by pointing out that his organs were engorged, consistent with digitalis. I hope I'm saying that right. The lack of evidence of natural disease and the absence of anything seen macroscopically, which could account for his death. This was obviously done in 1994, whenever technology had progressed far enough that they could maybe...
yeah, detect these things.
A lot of people saying this was just a long shot. This guy had just looked back at the case and just went, yep, he was poisoned. It's fine. Let's just close the case. It's poisoned.
Right, you know, okay, I mean? Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Let's just leave this. We don't need to investigate any further. Technology's moved on.
Who poisoned him? Does it matter? Does it really matter? Do we really care?
Yeah.
No, not enough.
But former South Australian Chief Superintendent Len Brown, who worked on the case in the 1940s, stated that he believed that the man was from a country in the Warsaw Pact, which I looked into, and this was a collective defensive treaty signed in Warsaw, Poland, between the Soviet Union and 7 other Eastern Bloc socialist republics of Central and Eastern Europe in May 1955, yeah, during the Cold War.
The Warsaw Pact is kind of what NATO, it's the counterance to NATO.
Yes, yeah. So I didn't know what that was. I had a look into it. And then this led to the police's inability to confirm the man's identity because he would have been like protected by this, I guess. Or interesting. I don't know how that works, but the South Australian Police Historical Society holds the plaster bust, which contains strands of the man's hair. And any further attempts to identify the body have been hampered by the embalming formaldehyde having destroyed many of the man's DNA fibers.
Yeah.
Other key evidence no longer exists, such as the brown suitcase, which was destroyed in 1986. And in addition, witness statements have disappeared from police files over the years.
I mean, one hand I can understand shit like that does happen, but like,
yeah,
just because there's this element of potential like spycraft,
espionage, yeah,
espionage, I'm like, yeah, maybe those things were just removed.
So 26th of April 1995, Prosper Thompson dies. The 17th of August 1995, Alf Boxall dies. And on the 13th of May 2007, Jessica Thompson died. On the 14th of October 2019, the Attorney General of South Australia grants conditional approval for the Somerton man's body to be exhumed in order for DNA sample to be obtained.
Whoa.
2019, this lady decides, you can dig him up. We can obtain the DNA that we need because we're going to close this case.
Is this 70? Am I doing this math right? 70 years after he was buried.
He's buried in 49.
Yeah. Holy shit. Mm-hmm. What's left?
The exhumation was carried out on the 19th of May 2021. Oh, so wow. That's like, what, 2 years ago?
Yeah, no, there's...
Crazy. Yeah. On this day, 2 years ago. There you go.
Perfect.
Police stated that the remains were in reasonable condition and were optimistic about the prospect of DNA recovery. The remains were deeper in the ground than previously thought. It was reported that the body was exhumed as part of Operation Preserve and Operation Persist, which are investigating historical unidentified remains in South Australia. The authorities have said that they intend to take DNA from the remains if possible, and Dr. Anne Coxon of the Forensic Science South Australia unit said, "The technology available to us now is clearly light years ahead of the techniques available when the body was discovered in the late 40s, and the tests would use, quote, every method at our disposal to try to bring closure to the end of this intriguing mystery."
I feel like we're getting close.
I want to jump a wee bit, though, back to a guy named Robin Thompson, because Jessica Thompson also had a son named Robin Thompson.
Okay, so she's the daughter, Kate, who said she was lying.
Who said she was lying. And she also has a son named Robin. And Robin Thompson is said to look... You can check out these pictures. I might try to post them on the Empty Promise Podcast Instagram page, actually, just so people can see it.
Mm-hmm.
But the son is said to look extremely like the Somerton man.
No way.
Yes. This is one theory. In May 2009, Abbott consulted with dental experts who concluded that the Somerton man had hyperdontia, which is a rare genetic disorder of both lateral incisors, which is a feature only present in 2% of the general population. In June 2010, Abbott obtained a photograph of Jessica Thompson's eldest son, Robin, which clearly showed that he, like the unknown man, had not only a larger symbiote than Cavum, but also hyperdontia. The chance that this was a coincidence has been estimated as 1 in 10 and 20 million.
Holy shit.
He has this same genetic condition that is...
The Somerton man, the mystery man had.
Yeah. The media have suggested that Robin Thompson, who was 16 months old in 1948, but who also died in 2009, may have been a child of either Boxall or the Somerton man and passed off as Prosper Thompson's son. DNA testing would confirm or eliminate this speculation, and Abbott believes an exhumation and an autosomal DNA test could link the Somerton man to a short list of surnames, along which existing clues of the man's identity would be the, quote, final piece of the puzzle. The biggest theory that kind of comes out of this one, Dee, is that this Somerton man was in town in 1948 when he died, trying to reconnect with Jessica at the time of his murder.
His son.
That they had an affair. He was trying to reconnect. She didn't want to. This was devastating for him. And then he took the book. He took the little part that his mom showed. It is finished. And then he committed suicide.
Oh, it is finished.
He was brokenhearted. You know, yeah.
I mean, imagine that as like a message from your former lover.
Yeah.
About like wanting to reconnect and her giving you like, finished.
Maybe he ripped out this page. He walked past, that car was open, he just threw the book in, that's why it ended up in the car.
Perhaps, yeah.
What, however, tends to throw this theory off is that there's a cipher in the book.
Yeah, right now, we've forgotten about that, haven't we?
And then Jess, who signs her name, capital J, capital E, you know, with that. Those that have studied ciphers say that she is undoubtedly linked to that code somehow. They just haven't found out what it is. In 2013, Abbott released an artistic impression that he commissioned of the Somerton man, believing that this might finally lead to an identification. All this time, we've been pushing the autopsy photo, and it's hard to tell what somebody looks like. In December 2017, Abbott announced three excellent hairs at the development stage for extracting DNA had been found on the plaster cast of the corpse and had been submitted for analysts analysis in the Australian Centre for Ancient DNA at the University of Adelaide. Processing the results could reportedly take up to a year while much of the DNA is degraded. And in February 2018, the University of Adelaide team obtained a high-definition analysis of the mitochondrial DNA from the hair sample from the Somerton man. They found that the Somerton man belonged to a haplogroup H4ALALLA.
No way.
Yeah, I know. Possessed by only 1% of Europeans. Okay. However, mitochondrial DNA is only inherited through the maternal line and therefore cannot be used to investigate a hereditary link between Abbott's wife and the Somerton man. On July 26, 2022, so last year, Abbott announced that he and genealogist Colleen Fitzpatrick had determined that this man was in fact a man named Carl Charles Webb. He was just known as Charles Webb, who was an electrical engineer and instrument maker born of the 16th of November 1905 in Footscray, a suburb of Melbourne. Abbott claimed that his DNA identification from strands of the hair found in the plaster cast made by South Australian police in the 1940s proved this, and through investigative genetic genealogy, matches were found for descendants of two distant cousins of Webb, both on paternal and maternal sides. None of Webb's still living relatives in 2022 had ever known him as a person, and initially there was no pre-death photographs of Webb, but further investigation uncovered his likely presence in 1921 in a football team photograph.
No way.
However, this image did not identify Webb directly or even clearly at the time.
He's named as being in the picture?
He's named as being in the picture.
It's difficult to actually identify him.
That's even him.
Okay.
So a little bit just on Carl Webb before we finish it. So this man, Carl Webb, who they reportedly have identified as being the Somerton man, his father died in 1939, who had emigrated to Australia from Hamburg, Germany. He was married to Eliza Amelia Morris Grace, who died in 1946 and had opened up a bakery in Springvale, Victoria. Carl Charles Webb, was born on the 16th of November 1905, the youngest of six children. The three sons would eventually work at the family bakery, and when it was closed down, Carl retrained as an electrical instrument maker. In 1941, he married Dorothy Doff Robertson, a pharmacist and chiropodist. The couple moved into a flat in Bromby Street, South Yarra. So this guy has seemed like a normal life.
Sounds that way.
The marriage, however, was not a harmonious one, largely due to Carl's personality. Dorothy described Carl as solitary, having few friends, living a quiet life, and being in bed by 7 p.m. each night, but also being moody, violent, and threatening, especially when facing defeat over relatively trivial matters. He was fond of poetry, wrote several poems of his own, most of them on the subject of death, which he claims to be his greatest desire. Dorothy stated this would be consistent with the copy of the Rubaiyat, which also focuses on the subject of death. Dorothy recalled one instance in 1946 when her husband apparently attempted suicide with an overdose of ether. She nursed him back to health, only for him to scold him for it and for him to become more violent. In September 1946, Dorothy fled from her husband following years of physical and verbal abuse. Carl moved out in 1947, and no official records revealing his subsequent whereabouts have ever been found. That's right up to 2022.
So basically, he was missing. He goes off the grid. He goes off the record. 1947. Shows up dead. 1949. Yet, yeah. 49.
The first this man has ever been heard of since is this DNA that apparently links him back, but it's still not even conclusive.
Okay.
Fully conclusive yet. In 1951, Dorothy was reportedly living in Butte, South Australia. And Abbott speculates that Carl may have gone to Adelaide intending to find her. She applied for a divorce on the 5th of June 1951, citing desertion. The divorce was granted in April 1952. Carl's oldest sister, Frieda Grace, was married to Thomas Gerald Keane.
Keane.
They also had a son named John, who died in World War II in 1943. Carl's brother Roy also died in a prisoner of war camp that same year. John's possessions included items which imply he resided in the US at some point, such as US coins and a map of Chicago.
This is the Keane guy. Okay.
And Freda Grace and Carl lived a 20-minute drive from each other. This would explain why the Somerton man was wearing clothes of US origin and with the name Keane on them. Mm-hmm. They could have been handed down to him from his brother-in-law or from his nephew. Abbott's research indicates that Webb enjoyed betting on horses, and thus these ciphers in the back of the book could have been bets or horse names.
Oh.
That's
true.
It's a stretch.
If that's true, that's very unfulfilling.
Is it? Derek Abbott and Colin Fitzpatrick believe that Carl had some serious mental health issues and spiraled down after losing 4 close relatives in 7 years. His history and autopsy findings suggested he committed suicide by poisoning himself. However, to this day, that is still not taken as the truth.
Mm.
We still don't know what happened to the Somerton Man. That's incredible. Our story of the Somerton Man, and there's a lot of theories to go on. Like,
oh yeah, like,
the main one being, I think I, after reading the whole story, I think I rest with this. Jess has something to do with it.
Still, big time. Yeah,
yeah, 100%. Maybe some kind of espionage or spy thing going on there. Maybe I just want to believe that because it's a cooler story.
Possibly, yeah. What? I mean, I think it's very likely that he may have somehow just committed suicide.
Yeah.
I mean, that crushed me whenever you said that, you know, he potentially was going back to reconcile with his woman, with his child, and then got this, like, basically, no, it is finished. And then that's the page from the book. It was very poetic that way. It sounds like the profile that they built up of him, you know, from the DNA evidence, that fits very nicely, I think. It kind of makes a lot of sense. And he just took that, you know, that's when he decided he'd just kill himself.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, sometimes you fit the character to the evidence.
Yes.
So... who's to say?
It's the cipher that kind of throws everything off as well.
The cipher, there's absolutely. There's no
reason for a cipher to be in the back of that.
Very book. Unusual. I mean, I'm not convinced by the idea it's betting slips and it's horse names and stuff like that.
Well, in 2004, the retired detective Gary Feltus, who we talked about, suggested in a Sunday Mail article that the final line, which read ITTMTSAMSTGAB, you know, such a line, could stand for the initials of "It's time to move to Australia, Moosley Street."
Moosley Street.
Mm-hmm. Jessica Thompson lived in Moosley Street, which is the main road through Glenelg where the man was
found. Interesting, interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if she was, as you know, potentially the idea that she was also working in espionage, then they'd have, that's another contact. She speaks Russian. His father's from Germany. 1939.
Yeah.
East Germany was a Warsaw Pact country, so, I mean, that links in as well. I kind of like the way that there's kind of really two endings here. Like, there's the ending that, like, obviously the investigator Abbott, right, has kind of put forward, and he's convinced of, or he's satisfied that, you know, there was this relationship, he was this kind of melancholy character, received some lots of bad news over the period of 7 years, and, you know, just decided to end it. But then there's also this, you know, these links, inklings, hints of espionage, missing file, or, you know, missing records, codes written on the back of the book.
I just think that this Jessica one, or Justin, whatever it is, I think she knows a hell of a lot more of the story than she was letting on. Like, she,
oh, absolutely,
she learnt Russian. She never told her daughter why she learnt Russian.
If you just think of, like, a person talking to the police, why would you lie about knowing him?
Yeah,
you know, I mean, that's one thing that she definitely says she didn't know him, didn't recognize him, but, like, almost conclusively she did.
She got super emotional when she seen that bust cast made of him.
But, you know, why lie? You know, he's the father of my illegitimate child.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Maybe she just didn't want that getting out.
Exactly, that was a huge thing back then too.
Exactly, you know? It could have been the motivation.
Different times.
But it's still strange, you know, under, you know, the protection of, like, a police investigation, you still wouldn't reveal that.
No. A lot of people saying it's kind of D.B. Cooper-esque. Nobody knows this man. Nobody knows where he went to, who he was. People still not believing that that case is closed, and that the Australian government or authorities are kind of just trying to put an end to it, wrap it up in a neat little package. That's it, done and dusted.
Exactly.
Let's leave it.
Sometimes when you hear these things, you're like, they just want to shut it down because they don't want any more questions asked. This guy Abbott seemed like he was attached to it for many years, like from 2002 forward, right? Yeah. So, like, my impression from what I've heard is that he actually wants to find the answers. It's not just a case of let's close this because, you know, there's too many questions around it.
Yeah.
I think he genuinely wanted to know the answers. And when he got that, like, DNA evidence, he found a profile that fit, and he was like, this is now satisfactory.
Yeah. Just going back to that, you said that the remains, they were part of Operation Preserve and Operation Persist, which are investigating historical unidentified remains in South Australia. There must be quite a few.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Like, this must be a more common thing that we know about.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. I would say, you know, the amount of, like, open cases that just there's not enough evidence for.
Yeah.
When you have today's methods, you can work it out. The whole DNA evidence thing reminds me of the podcast we did on the Golden State Killer.
Yes.
Because DNA evidence came back many years later in that one as well to play a pivotal role. If you haven't heard that one, check it out. It's in our backlog. It's very good. Yeah, I love this. You know, and what's crazy about it, right, is that Have you ever done those ancestry sites, ancestry.com?
Yeah, I've been onto them, but I never pay to go any further.
Exactly. Yeah. Know? Well, the amount of like cases, like police investigations that are getting solved because people are willingly submitting their DNA to a database so they can find out, oh, I'm descended from XYZ and blah, blah, blah.
Maybe it's all a conspiracy to do that.
Well,
I mean, that's what these sites are for. Maybe they were set up by detective agencies.
I would be interested to see, are they getting funding?
Yeah.
Like government funding?
Yeah.
Because obviously they're helping the police massively. And then people are willingly doing this because they want to find, I want to know my ancestry.
I mean, I'd still love to know my ancestry.
Exactly. You know? It's a kind of like a win-win, you know, but then other people are like, well, no, they have your DNA on file. Yeah. That's there forever. Yeah. But you're like, well, what good is my DNA? Maybe I'll get framed one day and I'll regret saying this. There's so many cases that are getting solved like this. People are just putting it up and then they're like, oh, your uncle, your third uncle, we can now pin him for this crime because of your DNA evidence.
Yeah.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. The fact that they're saying that this case is solved and that this man was Webb. Like, I don't know if that's... I think maybe they've just found someone who maybe, you know, that's the closest person to kind of fit the bill.
I think in terms of the DNA, I am pretty convinced...
That would be his?
I'm quite happy to say that the man is called Charles Webb, or there are, you know, there is records of a man called Charles Webb, and that these people knew him.
And he is the Somerton Man?
And that he is the Somerton Man. Now, that doesn't say... And that doesn't tell you why he was killed. That doesn't tell you what he did. Doesn't tell you if he was a spy or not.
Yeah.
Doesn't tell you if that's his real name.
It just tells you that that's the DNA provided for him.
Basically. Yeah. He can't lie about that. It's like lying about your thumbprint. Like, you know.
True.
He's just been identified. It doesn't mean... We don't know who he really was.
Yeah, you can't foil your DNA. Can you? Is there any way you can...
You know what? Probably
jig
is.
Jig the system?
Probably is, to be honest. That'll probably be a thing in a couple of years with AI and all this shit.
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty scary.
People will be like... changing their DNA.
I mean, it's still under the category of unsolved mystery.
That's what I mean. That, yeah.
You know, if you look at this anywhere, all over the internet, this never falls into like a closed case.
Open
this
and shut.
Still, the unsolved mystery of the Somerton Man.
That's why another reason I think this is so cool. This DNA evidence exists is that somebody in 5 years may find another clue and be able to use that DNA evidence to go, actually, here's proof that this guy was involved.
Yeah.
In
well, yeah,
true. Espionage.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because all we have is evidence of him in this scenario, but like, maybe there was, I don't know, military records about something that happened.
I suppose I like that. So yeah, we've seen that with a couple of cases we've covered actually, like that we could almost go back and reopen. Most recently, actually, was that I'm super like I'm heavily involved in at the minute. Is the Atlof Pass. I'd love to get back to that. There's a whole pile of stuff brought to light that we never talked about when we covered that story. The Forest Fen treasure, like it came out then later on. We didn't finish it.
If you haven't heard that podcast, go back and listen as well. There's a mysterious treasure.
DB Cooper
to be found.
Wasn't there more in
DB Cooper? Yeah, because stuff keeps showing up
never
every so often
closed,
in the woods.
Either.
Yeah,
like, yeah. Super interesting though.
Yeah, check out, because we've done all of those, Datlov Pass, DB Cooper, Forest Fan. Those are all episodes
in our archives.
Go check them out.
Case for the Somerton Man still remains, I think, a mystery.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's the story. Hope you enjoyed it, Dee.
I did. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I hope everybody listening enjoyed it. But that's all for today. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Remember, you can check out all of our previous podcasts over at EmptyPromisePodcast.com. You can find us on YouTube. You can find us on any podcast hosting service.
Yep, Spotify, Apple, Google.
Yep. Stay tuned in with our socials. So search for Empty Promise Podcast on Twitter or Instagram. They're a little dead in the water.
I mean, they're not.
They'll be updated now when this podcast goes out.
They might be
eventually.
I'm not.
and when you hear this, we hope it finds you well. Thank you all for tuning in, and we'll hopefully see you very soon with some more stories. Goodbye and God bless.
Bye-bye.